911, what's your emergency?
The dispatcher's voice is calm, but there's tension in the air. The HR manager on the other end is trying to explain. No one has heard from Janine Chapman in days. She hasn't called in. She hasn't answered messages. Something is wrong. And when the officers arrive at her apartment, that fear turns into reality. Blood, overturned furniture, the unmistakable smell of death. Janine was gone. And the man responsible? 200 miles away in a hospital, calmly telling doctors that he had gotten into a fight with his wife. This isn't just a tragic story. It's a case that exposes the deep failures in the system meant to protect victims of domestic violence. Today, we're exposing the warning signs that were missed, the system failures that left Janine vulnerable, and the hard truths about how cases like this keep happening. Welcome to Behind the Crime, the companion series to Sleuthy Stories, where we go beyond the case and break down key details, theories, and insights. I'm Sleuthy Lucy, and if you're here for expanded discussion, deeper analysis, and the hard truths behind these cases, you're in the right place. If you're new here, welcome. I hope you appreciate today's case coverage and consider subscribing. And for my returning truth seekers, welcome back. It's always good to have you here. In today's episode, we're talking about the Janine Chapman case. If you haven't already watched our full Sleuthy story, I highly recommend checking that out first for the full timeline. But if you're ready to go deeper, let's get started. So what did you think about this case? Did anything stand out to you? Did certain details linger in your mind? Because for me, the Janine Chapman case is one of those stories that just sticks with you. You hear about it once, and it lingers in your mind. The senselessness of it, the tragic loss of potential, the heartbreaking reality that it could have been prevented. And that's why we're here. To talk through the pieces that didn't quite fit into the structured Sleuthy Stories episode, and to explore those lingering questions that keep turning over in my head. Let's start with Janine herself, because before we talk about the crime, we need to remember who she was. Janine had one of those careers that just made you sit up and take notice. Personal assistant to the Duchess of York? Working at Def Jam? She moved in influential circles, crossing paths with industry giants like Russell Simmons, whose legacy in hip-hop is undeniable, though more recent reports have cast a shadow over his name. Even Muhammad Ali and Barack Obama were within her orbit. Janine was clearly someone who knew how to navigate powerful spaces. She was a woman on the move, ambitious, talented, and on the verge of launching her own business. At 46, she was about to step into her next chapter. And that's what makes her story even harder to process. She was on the cusp of something great. And in an instant, it was all taken away. Now, let's talk about James Michael Patrick. Janine met him while working in San Francisco, and for about 6 years, they were in an on-again, off-again relationship. It wasn't exactly stable. Then, in 2023, she got a new job in Dallas, his home state. That's when they made a big move. They moved in together. Then, just 2 months before her body was found, they got married. From the outside, it might have seemed like a fresh start, but her family saw the red flags. They described the relationship as unstable, and that's putting it lightly. Janine opened up to her sisters about the problems she was facing. Thank goodness she had them to confide in. Then came August 2023, the month before she was found dead. James choked Janine until she passed out. That's not just an argument gone too far. That's a near-fatal assault. That's attempted murder. Janine told one of her sisters what happened, and her sister begged her to leave. She pleaded with her to come stay with her, but Janine refused. She wanted to work things out herself. That's the kind of hold gaslighting and manipulation can have on someone. Even when the danger is crystal clear, even when someone is offering them an escape route, the psychological grip can keep them tethered. Janine did try to take action, though. She put James out, wanting to end things. Then came September 20th, just 5 days before she was found murdered. Janine called her manager, telling them she needed time off for domestic issues. It's chilling in hindsight, because by September 25th, she was expected back at work. And when she didn't show up, her boss called the police for a welfare check. This is where things took a really dark turn. The officers arrived at her apartment and found a horrific scene. Blood, overturned furniture, the unmistakable smell of death. Janine was on her bed, badly beaten. This wasn't just murder, it was rage. And while this discovery was being made in Dallas, James was 200 miles away in Austin. That same day, he checked himself into a hospital. He was admitted for an adverse reaction to an unknown substance. And that's why I have to wonder, was this a failed attempt at self-harm? Or was it another manipulation tactic? Was he trying to create an alibi to make it look like he was the one who needed help? This kind of behavior is sadly not uncommon in domestic violence cases. We saw this in the Alicia Watts and Zion Foster cases. Abusers often try to play the victim. They seek sympathy. They deflect blame. They might fake injuries, claim self-defense, even attempt self-harm, anything to avoid taking responsibility for their actions. We don't know exactly what was going through James's mind, but we've seen this pattern before. But then there's another chilling detail. During the examination, doctors noticed he had a black bloody fingernail. And that? That was a clue to what really happened to Janine. And it brings us back to that question, the one we keep having to ask. How do we prevent these tragedies from happening in the first place? Because the truth is, domestic abuse isn't always obvious. It's not always black and white. It's not always a bruised face or a broken bone. Abuse can be emotional, psychological, even financial. And the worst part? It often starts so subtly that even the victim doesn't see it at first. That's what makes it so dangerous. Take Janine's case. James was financially dependent on her. He belittled her, put her down. Those are forms of abuse, too. Financial control is a classic tactic that abusers use to isolate their victims, trap them. And the constant put-downs, the gaslighting, that's emotional abuse. It might not leave visible scars, but it cuts just as deep. And here's the thing, there were signs, long before Janine. Before he ever met her, James already had a history of aggression. He had prior charges, including one for making terroristic threats. Even though it was dismissed, it still paints a picture, one of anger, control, and intimidation. A pattern that should have set off alarms long before things escalated, long before they even got together. And then there's this fact. Janine's own family had no idea she was even married. Let's just sit with that for a second. Imagine learning about it, not from your sister, but from your mother. The shock, the confusion. How could something this big, this life-altering, have happened without her sister's knowing? They weren't just surprised, they were blindsided. Janine wasn't just their sister, she was their role model, someone they admired, respected, looked up to. And yet, she kept this secret. And when the reality of who she had married finally sank in, that shock turned into something else. Dread. James Michael Patrick. They knew him. They saw past the facade, the charm, the excuses, the manipulation. They recognized what Janine couldn't, and their concerns weren't unfounded. They actually compared James to Ted Bundy. That's a chilling comparison. And unfortunately, in the end, it wasn't far off. They knew about the on-again, off-again nature of their relationship. They had seen red flags before, the arguments, the instability, the financial dependence, the manipulative behavior, the controlling tendencies. It was all there. It's a pattern we see way too often in domestic violence cases. And yet, it still happens. Why? Gaslighting is a big part of it. It's not just a buzzword. It's a real and devastating form of emotional abuse. Victims are made to doubt their own reality, second-guess their instincts, and in some cases, even defend their abuser to others. And if you think this only happens in personal relationships, think again. We're seeing gaslighting play out on a massive scale in today's political landscape. Leaders, officials, and media figures twisting facts, denying documented events, and making people question what they saw with their own eyes. It's a tactic that thrives on confusion, and when used effectively, it can make people doubt even the most obvious truths. That's how powerful it is. And here's the thing. It doesn't just affect those who are vulnerable. Some of the smartest, most well-educated people can fall victim to gaslighting because it plays on emotion, not just logic. When the messaging is constant, when the pressure to conform is high, even those who pride themselves on critical thinking can start to question reality. That's how deep this tactic runs. And when we understand gaslighting in personal relationships, we start to see how it manipulates entire groups of people in the real world. That kind of psychological conditioning is powerful, and it can make even the strongest, most successful people stay in dangerous situations longer than they should. But then we get to the escalation, August 2023. James chokes Janine until she loses consciousness. This was a foreshadowing of what was to come. Someone demonstrating that they are capable of taking a life. And yet, he wasn't arrested. Let's just take a second to really let that sink in. Because this is the moment where things could have been different, where intervention might have saved her life. But the system failed her, not because she called the police, which she didn't, but because James had prior violent charges that should have served as a warning. There should be a system in place where individuals can access critical information about a partner's history of violence before it's too late. Some states allow access to criminal records, but these databases are often incomplete, difficult to navigate, or restricted. Background checks, while useful, also have limitations. Many dismissed charges don't appear, and private services don't always have accurate or updated information. A handful of states have domestic violence registries, but these are not universal and often exclude critical cases. In the UK, Clare's Law allows people to request information from the police about a partner's violent history. However, there is no equivalent law in Texas or many other U.S. states. If something like this had been available, Janine, or anyone in a similar situation, could have had access to crucial information that might have influenced her decisions. Perhaps there should be a national domestic violence registry, similar to the sex offender registry, that makes repeat violent offenders publicly known. Without a system like this, victims are often left in the dark, unaware of the potential danger they are in until it's too late. If Janine had been aware of his past, maybe she could have made a more informed decision about her safety. Instead, she, like so many others, had no real way of knowing the danger she was in until it was too late. Perhaps there should be a system in place to alert potential partners to repeat violent offenders, to ensure that people like Janine or anyone in the dating scene have access to crucial information that might change the course of their decisions. With the rise of the manosphere and incel culture, women need to be more aware than ever that big problems can come in handsome packages. The surge of online communities fostering misogyny and resentment toward women only strengthens the case for an alert system, one that flags individuals with a history of partner violence. And this isn't just about men. Such a system should identify anyone with a pattern of violent behavior, regardless of gender. The fact that his history of aggression wasn't flagged in a way that could have protected her is yet another failure in a long list of systemic shortcomings. And I can't stop thinking about how many other people it's failing in this very moment. What makes this even more heartbreaking is that Janine did reach out. She told one of her sisters about the choking incident, and her sister tried to convince her to leave, even offering for her to come live with her. But Janine stayed. And this just goes to show the kind of chokehold, pun intended, that gaslighting can have on someone. Then we have the timeline leading up to her death, the moving furniture, that eerie security footage of James removing things from their apartment in the days before her body was found. Was he planning to leave? Was he setting things up for a cover-up? Did he already know what he was about to do? Or did he already do it on that first day he was caught on camera? These are the kinds of questions that haunt me when I think about this case. Can you imagine the kind of evil it takes to go back into that apartment after having done what he did to her? And then, the moment everything comes to a head, September 25th. No one has heard from Janine in 5 days. Her HR manager calls for a welfare check. And what police find is, straight out of a nightmare, a real-life nightmare on Elm Street, Janine's body, unrecognizable from the sheer violence of the attack. That's not just murder. That's rage. That's personal. Meanwhile, James is in Austin, checking himself into a hospital. And when doctors notice his bloody fingernail and ask what happened, he says, "I got in a fight with my wife." A fight? That's how he described it? He wasn't even trying to hide the fact that this wasn't just a verbal argument. It was a physical altercation, one that resulted in an injury to himself, notwithstanding the unimaginable damage he inflicted on Janine. The sheer casualness of that response is chilling, unbelievable. So what do we take away from this? First, domestic violence doesn't always start as physical abuse. It begins with manipulation, control, slowly stripping away someone's sense of autonomy and self-worth. By the time the violence starts, the emotional damage has already been done. It doesn't matter how smart, successful, or strong the person is. It can happen to anyone. And that's why we shouldn't judge people based on whether they stay or leave. We should be persistent in our pleas to help instead. While their thinking may have been affected by manipulation and gaslighting, there are ways to counter this. One of the most effective approaches is to acknowledge their feelings and concerns without reinforcing the abuser's narrative. Instead of saying, "Why don't you just leave?" try saying, "I understand that you love them, but love shouldn't come with fear." Instead of challenging their reality outright, offer an alternative view. "I know they apologize, but does their behavior actually change? What do their actions tell you?" Best practices for supporting someone in this situation include listening without judgment. Let them express their thoughts without feeling shamed or pressured. Planting seeds of doubt about the abuse. Gently question inconsistencies in the abuser's behavior. Offering support without ultimatums. Let them know they have a safe space with you when they're ready. Providing resources. Share information on domestic violence hotlines and local support networks. Being consistent and patient. Breaking free from an abusive situation is a process, not a single moment. When we approach these conversations with respect, patience, and consistency, we create openings for victims to reclaim their reality, one step at a time. Second, the system is still failing victims. Janine should have been protected the moment James choked her unconscious. But time and time again, we see cases where intervention comes too late. And even when victims do take legal steps, like filing for a restraining order, it's important to recognize the limitations of that protection. A restraining order is only effective for those who are willing to abide by the law. But if the abuser is violent and unhinged, that piece of paper won't physically stop them from causing harm. It's a tool, not a shield. So what should someone do in addition to filing a restraining order? Create a safety plan. Identify a safe place to go, whether that's a shelter, a friend's house, or a relative's home. And most importantly, don't tell your abuser where you are. So many victims make this mistake, thinking that explaining their departure will create closure or prevent escalation. But in reality, it can give the abuser the opportunity to track them down and manipulate them into coming back. Silence and secrecy can be powerful tools for protection. We saw this in the Toni Wells case, where she had expressed fears about her husband, but still ended up being tracked down and killed. It's a tragic example of how abusers manipulate victims into staying connected, even when they're in danger. Change daily routines. Abusers often stalk their victims, so avoiding predictable patterns can make a difference. Keep emergency contacts informed. Make sure trusted people know the situation and can check in regularly. Consider legal self-defense options. Depending on local laws, This could mean carrying pepper spray, learning self-defense techniques, or taking other security measures. The key takeaway? A restraining order is a step, not a solution. It should be combined with real-world protective actions to maximize safety. Victims need support, not just from the legal system, but from their community, friends, and advocates who can help them take the next steps toward real protection. Third, we have to talk about these cases, not just in the moment, but consistently. Because if we stop talking about them, they fade into the background, and the cycle continues. And that's why I do this. That's why this conversation matters. If you or someone you know is in an unsafe situation, help is available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is a confidential resource that provides support and safety planning. You can reach them at 1-800-799-7233 or visit thehotline.org. And listen, if you ever suspect that someone in your life is in danger, reach out. Be there. Sometimes, just knowing that someone sees them and believes them can be the first step toward getting help. Janine's story is one that should never have happened. It's easy to get lost in the legal details, the case files, the court proceedings. But at the end of the day, this isn't just a case. This was Janine's life. And that's what her family wanted people to remember. I keep thinking about the testimony her loved ones gave, how hard that must have been for them, to stand in a courtroom, to relive it all, to fight through the grief just to make sure the world knew who Janine really was. They painted a beautiful picture of her, not as a victim, but as a person full of life and love. They talked about her infectious laugh, the kind that could light up a room. They spoke about her love for her nieces, how she adored them and cherished every moment with them. And they shared her passion for her work, how she was always striving for more, always working towards something bigger. She wasn't just successful, she was ambitious, driven. Janine was so much more than the way her life ended. She was compassionate. She was full of life. She was deeply loved. She had plans. She had dreams. And that's what makes this so hard to process. She should still be here. And then, there was one little detail that really stuck with me. Janine once took in a friend's dog, Stevie, because it needed surgery. She nursed it back to health, treating it like it was her own. That's the kind of heart she had. She wasn't just kind. She was thoughtful, nurturing, and full of love. She rescued an animal. And yet, when she needed saving, no one was able to rescue her. That's what makes this so gut-wrenching. And that's why we have to keep talking about cases like this. Because if we don't, how many more Janines will there be? That wraps up this episode of Behind the Crime, where we take a deeper look at the cases covered in Sleuthy Stories. If you enjoyed this breakdown, be sure to follow the Sleuthy Stories podcast so you never miss an episode. And if there's a detail or theory you'd like to discuss further, let me know. I love hearing your thoughts. Until next time, stay safe, stay aware, and take care.